Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Good to have you along today. In Valley traffic, I-10 westbound, a crash blocks the exit ramp at 35th Avenue. And on the 202 westbound, the Red Mountain Freeway, a crash at 24th Street. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 103. That's right around average for today. It'll be clear tonight with overnight lows in the mid-80s. Sunny for both tomorrow and Sunday. Highs each day right around 105. Right now in Phoenix, under sunny skies, it's 100 degrees. In June, Cottonwood became the first city in Arizona to ban the sale and use of tobacco, nicotine, and vapor products to anyone under the age of 21. The group that spearheaded the effort said it would try and enact similar bans in other Verde Valley communities. And as KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports, that's exactly what they're doing.
The Yavapai County Anti-Smoking Coalition of Youth stood before the Clarkdale Town Council on Tuesday in hopes they would craft a similar ordinance. Councilman Bill Regner says he would support such a measure, but...
My concern is that people who are merely in possession of it, you know, do we want to be regulating that kind of lifestyle choice? I'm much more comfortable with an ordinance that prohibits the sale of the products to that age group.
Regner says the town council will likely revisit the matter when they meet again in September. Cottonwood's town council had asked the coalition to work with neighboring cities to up the age to avoid unfairly penalizing businesses. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Oral arguments are taking place at this hour in the case brought by opponents of the newly certified ballot measure legalizing recreational marijuana in Arizona. I caught up earlier with Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services and asked him what he expected to hear from opponents of Prop 205.
It comes down to a question of whether both the signers of the petitions and the people who will be voting on it actually get to know what it does. Arizona law requires that every measure have a 100-word summary. And by definition, a summary is, you know, a little of this, a little of that, to give you an idea of what's in the next 35 pages. The challengers contend that the summary fails to notify people of all the effects on the business community, on driving laws, on Landlord-Tenant Act, and therefore folks didn't understand it. They're also claiming that even within the wording of the initiative itself, that it's misleading, and it does not point out that, for example, while it remains illegal to drive while impaired under marijuana, there is no statutory definition of impairment. So based on that, they're going to argue to the judge that it is legally insufficient to go before voters in November.
How do the supporters counteract that?
Well, they say that it's frivolous. What they have going in their favor is a couple of things. Number one is, while the summary is what appears on the petition page, by law, the actual initiative has to be attached to every petition. So while it may be impractical to read the next 35 pages, if people wanted to, they can see it. It is there to see. It's also posted on the web. And as far as some of the public policy things on impairment and Landlord-Tenant Act and everything else, I think the best argument that the opponents have is, look, those are interesting public policy questions, and we'll get to debate those over the next couple of months, and we'll let the voters decide rather than simply killing it, in its crib.
Howie, are we expecting the judge to decide one way or the other at the end of these arguments? Presumably they have to act quickly, right?
Well, there could be a ruling at the end of the day today, because unlike the cases we've been following on minimum wage and hospital pay, those involve questions of whether the circulators were legally qualified to gather signatures. And that involves going through petition by petition and determining one by one which name should be struck. This is simply a question of law. There are no facts to present. It's simply, what does the law require an initiative and a summary to say, and does this comply? And so I could certainly see Judge Gentry at the end of this saying, look, based on what I've heard, here's my conclusion, and I will issue a written ruling as soon as possible, because we know whoever loses is going to take this to the Supreme Court.
That's Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. We spoke earlier this afternoon about the oral arguments going on at this hour on the ballot measure to legalize recreational marijuana in Arizona. The Arizona Corporation Commission yesterday decided a closely watched rate case. It involved a small utility called UNS, but observers say the outcome in that case could have implications for solar fees charged by bigger utilities. Rachel Leingang of the Arizona Capital Times covered the hearing and a contentious staff meeting that followed, and she joins me. So, Rachel, what did the commission ultimately decide with UNS?
So UNS, as you mentioned, they're one of the first utility that's actually going through the process of trying to address solar in their rates and potentially changing the way they design their rates for everyone. And so a lot of utilities had intervened in this and were paying close attention just to kind of get a feel for how the commissioners were going to weigh in on it. And what UNS had initially asked for were mandatory demand charges for solar customers and big changes to net metering. But the commission ultimately only approved a $1.58 fee monthly for solar customers that only really covers the capital costs of an additional meter that the solar groups had said, you know, that isn't a real cost. We do agree with that. So there wasn't really much controversy on that. And then there's a second phase that's expected now of this rate case that will look at the bigger potential changes to solar after a different docket and proceeding related to the value and cost of solar outside of any utility's rate case. After that's completed, then you'll commence a second phase of this rate case that'll just look at solar issues.
So what are folks saying about what the commission did and how that might affect other utilities, most notably APS?
So the solar groups, the advocacy groups, were saying, they really praised the commission for the way the process went, that they looked at all the facts and decided we have a better way of doing this once we go through this other proceeding, and we need to make sure that we follow the best process here because it is a quasi-judicial body. You know, they do have the force of judges, so they need to make sure that everything is based on the factual record. I think for solar groups that was probably a win, and they're looking at other rate cases as potentially having that same outcome where they want to look at the value in solar first before doing anything in the actual rate cases. But it does still heavily depend on whatever happens in that other docket, and we really don't know yet. We don't know what the outcome will be there, if it'll be beneficial for utilities or for solar or for neither or both.
Now, it wasn't all sort of unicorns and rainbows at this meeting. At times, in discussing another issue, some of the commissioners got pretty testy with each other, didn't they?
Yeah, so that was in a staff meeting after the UNS case was decided. And this has all been revolving around this dark money issue that sort of clouded the commission for the last 2 years or so after the 2014 election. Corporation Commissioner Bob Burns is trying to get utilities to disclose any spending that they've done on electioneering, and he's been trying to do that for about a year and a half now. He had hired an attorney to do an investigation of outside influences on the commission, and the other commissioners, first of all, didn't know that he had hired the attorney until it was publicly put out in a press release, and they didn't take too kindly to that. And then they really quibbled with, you know, whether the investigation was necessary, and then sort of some of the things that they've been taking personally with what Burns has said. You know, he's saying the commission has no integrity, and the other commissioners take that as a slight on their own integrity.
So is this the end of Bob Burns' quest to find out who was behind that money, or is there another avenue that he can take now?
There's a couple things he could do. The commissioners each have office budgets that they can use for whatever they see fit. And if he wanted to hire this attorney through his office budget, he could potentially do that. But he's said that he doesn't have the same amount of money in there and he wouldn't be able to afford it. He could just do a subpoena of APS, which is what he has initially been trying to do. And he would likely need the commission staff to help him with that. Whether there's a way that the other commissioners could block that, I don't know. They could try to. So that there's always that potential that if he does try to do something else, that it could be blocked again. And certainly he's the only one who's been interested in doing this. The other commissioners think it's a First Amendment right, and they kind of don't want to rehash the past here. Like I said, it's been 2 years, so they're trying to move forward.
Rachel Leingang with the Arizona Capital Times. Rachel, thanks.
Thank you.
The Rio Olympics are about to close out their first week, and already there have been some breakout performances across the games. Adrian Hobart, deputy editor for World Sport at the BBC, joins me with a look back and a look forward to the next several days. And Adrian, first off, what are you most excited about coming up today?
I should stay excited about Michael Phelps winning more and more golds. Three more, I suppose, potentially taken from this Games. And, of course, you know, I expect him to take a 23rd gold when he hits the pool in the butterfly. But if you're looking at the swimming pool, I'm really excited about Katinka Hosszú of Hungary, who has won three already and could add a fourth and has pushed Hungary way up the medals table beyond their wildest dreams, which is fantastic to see. So she has been a breakout star. I'm not sure if she's getting traction in the United States, but she has done a fantastic job. I'm also excited about the athletics starting, and we have witnessed something of world stature. I mean, one of the historic races by Almaz Ayana. They decided to move the athletics, some of the gold medal events, into the morning session. And it's a great tragedy to me that very few people are actually in the João Havelange Stadium witnessing this performance by this Ethiopian runner, who only moved up to 10,000 metres this year. And she has smashed a world record that has stood for 23 years by 14 seconds. She was lapping almost the entire field by the end of the race. It is one of the greatest performances by a woman runner ever at the Olympics, quite simple. And that has really set the bar high for the rest of the athletics.
Adrian, you mentioned Michael Phelps in the pool, and folks like Michael Phelps and Katie Ledecky, Simone Biles, have generated enormous buzz here in the U.S. Are their performances generating as much interest in other parts of the world?
Without question, they are. Yes, indeed. I think that Simone Biles has really caught the eye here. We're talking about it a lot today in the United Kingdom and talking about it to our listeners because, you know, it's just such a great story from, you know, the unpromising start to her life. And at 4'8", you know, when they put, I've seen the photographs of Phelps and Biles together, it's just ludicrous.
It's something.
Isn't it? It is something. So, you know, what she's doing with gymnastics, which is such a strong feature of the first week of competition, has truly captured the imagination. And now I think she's in that position. Could she become a world icon in the way that Olga Korbut or Nadia Comăneci were able to do in earlier games? That is what we're talking about here. Someone who could propel herself to a name that is synonymous with her sport, and that would be fantastic. Phelps, clearly, you may detect a little fatigue in my approach to Michael Phelps. Not least, I mean, I appreciate he is talking to NBC, I'm told, after his races. He's not talking to any other of the other world's media, and that has not done him any favours. You know, he's a machine, isn't he, in terms of winning golds, and no one can take the achievement away. But perhaps you would argue, and I've had this argument with colleagues in the last week or so, is he the greatest Olympian? Well, is he the man, if you put him getting off the aircraft anywhere in the world, would people mob him in the way that they would Usain Bolt? No, is the simple answer. So that's an interesting thing. And Katie Ledecky's performances have been fantastic too. And, you know, she has raised eyebrows. These are the blue ribbon events of the first week with that question in the pool and the gymnastics. But once the athletics kicks in, you know, people are very rude about the rest of the Olympics once the athletics kicks in because they say now the real games have started.
The vice president of the IOC has made comments during these games about this being the most difficult Olympics because of financial and political issues. What kind of fallout, what kind of reaction has that been generating?
Yeah, it's John Coates is the man in question. He's never short of an answer, and we knew that because it was actually an interview with my colleague Alex Capstick from the BBC that he said all these things. He said it's the toughest, as you say, games that there's ever been. And he said, look, the IOC knew it would be difficult. We were never expected to be this bad. It was basically his thrust, looking at all the different issues that have broken out. I mean, he pointed out one that was quite worrying, frankly, which was the medical provision, because one of the big names here in rugby union was a guy called Sonny Bill Williams, and he got injured, very badly injured, ruptured Achilles. He had to wait an hour and a half for an ambulance to take him to hospital, and then the ambulance driver didn't know where to take him and took him to the wrong hospital. So that was something that Coates pointed out. And so, you know, he said that being fair to Brazil, we knew there would be problems, but what we thought would happen hasn't happened. We were promised all sorts of things. But one thing he did make a point, and you know, I have a lot of sympathy for Brazil. You know, when they gave the games to Brazil, Brazil was on course to becoming the fifth biggest economy in the world. It's now the 74th as a result of recent collapse in the economy. So you can understand why corners have had to be cut. They can't afford to do it. And it's been a massive problem for the city of Rio itself.
Adrian Hobart is Deputy Editor of World Sport at the BBC. Adrian, thanks a lot.
Mark, it's a great pleasure.
And one more Olympics note, the three-time defending champion U.S. women's national soccer team will miss the Olympic final for the first time after being ousted by Sweden on penalties that followed a 1-1 draw in the quarterfinals earlier today. This was the first time an Olympic women's match had gone to penalties and is the earliest the U.S. has ever been eliminated from the Olympics since women's soccer became a sport in 1996. Chandler is looking for proposals to turn a vacant building downtown into a vibrant part of the area. City officials are hosting a site tour on Monday morning. Proposals are due next month. The former ICANN building site is a little more than half an acre on the southeast corner of Washington and Chicago streets. Kim Moyers is Chandler's downtown redevelopment manager. And Kim, what's behind this project?
We think that this is a great redevelopment opportunity to really bridge our historic core further down south and start creating a larger footprint for our downtown.
What ideally would you like to see go into that building?
We would love to see what we're calling the best of local concepts. So we want people to be creative, but it's two buildings, each of them about 3,000 square feet, and then there's a considerable amount of green space that's on the property as well. So we think this would be a great opportunity for one or two restaurants, whether it be outdoor entertainment, outdoor seating. We think it has a lot of potential, and there is a city parking garage that's directly across the street for parking, and it is diagonal to our city hall for a ready employment base.
How wedded to that concept are you? Like, for example, if somebody comes by and says, hey, we'd like to put an office building in there, we'd like to put something that is not like a restaurant or entertainment in there, would you be amenable to that?
That's a great question. While we are suggesting that this be the best of the locals, we are open to other options. If it feels the look and the desire of our redevelopment plan, we most certainly will entertain those options. So we don't want to stifle anybody's creativity or vision for the space.
When you're deciding what to ultimately put in there and to whom you're going to sell this, how much of it is going to come down to what the building and the space will be used for, and how much of it will come down to how much money the city will get from it?
You know, this is really about finding the right use for the building. It's important that we find a use that will continue the pedestrian pathway south of the historic square. We have our new Ulta Steelyard Lofts that's opened in the fall of 2015, and we think that that's a continued growth pattern in that area, and we have quite a few of those people that are traveling up north, and we think it would be a good transition piece. So we are looking for the right fit more than anything. Obviously, it'll be at market rates, but that's not the focus of the project. The focus is finding the right use.
So is the city potentially willing to turn down more money for a project that it feels is better for that area?
I think that you'll see that we'll find that we will look for the best use. Correct.
How do you envision whatever this space turns into fitting into the rest of what is already in this area and what Chandler already has going on in its downtown?
Well, we have a very low vacancy rate for both retail and for office. So we know that we need to continue to develop to the south. So I think that that's important for this piece of property. We know that with the development of Chandler 87, which is the former Site 6 building that's right across from City Hall, we could be getting as 169,000 square feet of new office in there, which will bring in another 600 to 800 employees. So we want to make sure that we have plenty of opportunities for people to eat down here during lunch, during the dinner, and also entertainment options for the weekend.
Kim Moyers is Chandler's downtown redevelopment manager. Kim, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The University of Arizona is one of 11 schools chosen to take part in a program to offer free textbooks to students. Under the OpenStax initiative, students can access free peer-reviewed textbooks anywhere in the world. Cheryl Coulier is an associate librarian and the Open Education Resource Coordinator at the University of Arizona Libraries. And Cheryl, which students have been able to use these so far?
They're primarily in the areas of math and science and the social sciences and humanities. There's about 20 titles. They just released one on American government last week, and they've got three more in the works on astronomy and microbiology and university physics. They've been heavily used at the U of A. Last school year, we had over 2,000 students using introductory statistics and over 300 students using college physics. And those free books replaced commercial textbooks that retail for over $240 if somebody went to, say, Amazon and tried to buy them new online for free.
So in your mind, then, is sort of the main benefit of this program cost savings for students?
Well, it's cost savings, but it's also it really feeds into student success and retention. I mean, the cost of higher education is a huge issue, especially in Arizona. And as a librarian, I can't do a whole lot about the tuition and fees, but I can do something about the cost of course materials. And that's where these open educational resources are so exciting.
What was it about the U of A that you think led the organizers to include you in this program now?
We've been involved in open educational resources since 2014. We started out with two open textbooks and two courses, about 60-some students. And last academic year, we had over 3,000 students enrolled in courses using open textbooks. So the University Libraries has formed a partnership with our Office of Instruction and Assessment and IT and Bookstore and Disability Resource Center and Student Government. So a wide campus coalition has set up what we call the OER Action Committee to work on open educational resource initiatives and spread the word. That's one of the biggest hurdles for OER adoption is really raising faculty awareness that these are available as options to them.
Yeah, I was curious about that. I mean, do you find that instructors are interested in using these kinds of textbooks?
You know, once they find out that they're out there, yes, they're very interested. Part of the challenge is actually finding them. There's no central repository yet for open textbooks.
At what point do you think for the U of A that you will achieve critical mass? I mean, how many subjects, how many students enrolled in courses that use open textbooks? At what point do you think that'll happen?
That's a good question. It's ultimately faculty choice. They have the academic freedom to choose whatever materials they think are best for their course and best for their learning objectives. And I think as the quality of open educational resources grows and the availability of all of the different materials, I really hope to see more and more open textbooks adopted.
Are there particular subjects that you're really hoping to get for open textbooks? I mean, anything that would really sort of help give you a little bit more momentum?
In foreign languages, there aren't a lot of materials yet. We've had requests for them. And I do work with faculty one-on-one. They'll come and say, you know, I'd really like to find an open textbook for my course. And we'll look and search. And sometimes they're not available yet or not quite what they're looking for. So in that case, we do, to save students money, can look at library ebooks that have multi-user licenses. And so that's another way that we can save students money.
Cheryl Coulier is an associate librarian and the Open Education Resource Coordinator at the University of Arizona Libraries. It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody, here with KJZZ's Phil Latzman.
And Mark, if you're looking for a remote, dark, and perhaps spooky place to
watch... As I always am.
Yeah, of course. You want to be out there to watch the Perseid meteor shower in Arizona. And maybe you're willing to sacrifice some sleep.
Sure.
Well, you have little kids, so you do that already. Well, you are, and your kids, and everyone else, invited to Lost Dutchman State Park in Apache Junction.
Yeah, that's where a gathering of park regulars and stargazers will meet this evening, and we'll pull an all-nighter into early tomorrow to get an under-the-stars view of what scientists are calling a rare outburst of meteors in the skies this year.
Although I don't recommend it for little children. Joining us now is Kim Grady, who is on the Parks Board and is helping to arrange this unique event. Now, first of all, for those of us who don't know about Lost Dutchman, tell us about this mysterious park and place.
Lost Dutchman State Park is a beautiful park at the foot of the Superstition Mountains. If you know of that mountain range, it's one of the most beautiful and well-known landmarks in Arizona, known, of course, for the Jacob Waltz gold mine, and his nickname was the Dutchman, so hence the name. The park is famous for its great hiking up into the mountain and into the national forest up there is just amazing. Some of the most amazing trails in our state.
So when I mentioned Lost Dutchman State Park to the folks in the newsroom that I work with, my colleagues here at KJZZ, a lot of them looked at me in horror and said, oh my goodness, that place is spooky and it's dangerous. How did it get its reputation?
Well, there's a lot of both Native American and American myths around it. The Native American myths come from the superstitions they have about the mountains. The superstitions came mainly from sounds and wind and, you know, things that the Native Americans would hear up in the mountains, and so it just kind of got that reputation. It's also very treacherous terrain, just so you know.
That I've heard. How did it come to be that you all decided to get together at Lost Dutchman and do this meteor gazing?
In 2010, the Friends of Lost Dutchman is a nonprofit that formed because the state was going to shut our park, nine of our parks down, actually, due to revenue issues. The park is near and dear to our hearts, so we formed this organization. And one of the ways to save the park was to create activities and programs in the park. And I happen to know Dr. Sky. His real name is Steve Cates, but he's a leading authority on the skies. And he and I talked about starting star parties in the park. And so we did.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a neat thing if you can either stay up late or get up early to participate in this. Can folks come along and meet you somewhere and participate in your stargazing, meteor gazing?
Absolutely. We're going to be in the park from 8 until dawn. There's a little bit of a glitch here because the 8 until 10 o'clock show where we have entertainment, we serve food and things like that, those tickets are sold out. So we've got that booked. But after 10 o'clock, in fact, around 9:30, public can come in, pay their park entrance fee, come on down, follow the signs on down to the event, and, you know, just hang out with me. I'll be at the entrance. Dr. Sky is going to start some amazing presentations. He's going to be on two-way radio talking to folks, to experts at NASA about meteors and space and things like that. He's going to, we do music. Sometimes we'll show a really cool movie to get people in the mood. You know, we'll do things like that. So all night long, there's something going on.
Kim Grady is on the board of Lost Dutchman State Park, where there'll be a Perseid meteor watching party. Sounds great. Thanks, Kim, for your time.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Phil.
And that's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. The chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts is in the Valley, and it's part of her national tour celebrating the NEA's 50th anniversary. Jane Chu joins me. And Jane, let me ask you first off, do you think the role of the arts and arts education has evolved over the past several years?
We focus solely on the fact that the arts are not off in a corner by themselves. They're not isolated. And so when it comes to arts education, we see such a key role, even through our own research and others, that the arts make such a difference for children and youth in so many different ways, including other academic subjects, and especially for children and students who come from low opportunities in the social and economic areas, low-income neighborhoods. It really makes a difference, especially for them. So we love it when we're able to see arts education in action in so many different ways.
Arts organizations here in Arizona and around the country have been facing funding challenges for several years now. What do groups like yours, what do activists like yourself do about that?
Those types of situations happen within each specific community. So when you've seen one community, you've really only seen one community. But when it comes to funding, there are all kinds of ways everyone is looking at, and that's one of the things that we're really pleased about when we fund specific arts projects, is that they leverage other dollars. For example, when you look at the National Endowment for the Arts grants, we require a one-to-one match. But what we've done as a part of our own analysis of our grants is that we've seen that for every dollar that the National Endowment for the Arts awards, another $7 to $9 of other outside funding for the same arts project comes in. So we like the leveraging and the collaboration of that type of the way, you know, a dollar can spark additional giving and involvement of others in the same arts project. And so it's looking like that type of funding is coming and necessary.
Do you think that in order to maintain that, arts organizations need to sort of broaden their bases as opposed to having maybe a particular group of donors or supporters or attendees who tend to fund most, if not everything, that those groups do?
Well, it really is the more the merrier and those kind of things. And our experience is even when we have, some very loyal, and we're so appreciative of those arts patrons who've really stood by specific arts organizations and projects over the years, they even look and appreciate the ability to see that it reaches out to other people in the community. But yes, we no longer see that there's a single magic formula. There's more like a bunch of smaller magic formulas.
What are some of the emerging art forms or trends in the arts world that you are most excited about sort of getting more national prominence?
We're really appreciating, we're seeing that there is more of an increased recognition that there's something for everyone in the arts, and the arts aren't all, you know, siloed by themselves. There's something for everyone, and with that comes several things. One is we're starting to see a mashup, not only between different art forms, but also arts in conjunction with other non-art sectors. We'll see arts connected with science and technology and engineering and math. And we're starting to see a recognition from, say, businesses who are looking for the creativity that comes from arts, who so love and get energized by being able to stand in the middle of ambiguity and really make something up from nothing. So that's happening, the giant mashup. And then we're also seeing a recognition of different art forms at all kinds of levels. For example, a true appreciation of the different folk and traditional arts, how so many of us have different backgrounds and heritage, and we can celebrate all of that. It's certainly a form of expression, and that is also coming to the fore.
Jane Chu is chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. Jane, thank you very much.
And thanks so much.
Social media has become an important business tool today to help grow a business or shape a personal brand. But we've all mostly used Facebook and Instagram to document our lives. So what if you're no good at it? What can you do then? Well, there's a class for that. The show's Lauren Gilger has been poking around on this. And Lauren, these exist?
They do. I didn't know it either until I saw an ad for an Instagram class. This one was set up by a local PR firm in Scottsdale. And the idea is they'll teach you how to take better Instagram photos of your food. So I needed to find out what there is to know about taking a good food picture with your phone and posting it for your friends. And it turns out there's a lot more to it than I thought.
You want to have a good following. You know, you have to have your hashtags. You have to have a clean looking grid, but you also have to be posting consistently for people to want to follow you.
Angela Schuster is talking to a dozen people sitting at a long table in the back of a swanky Scottsdale restaurant.
One of the most important things is, when are you going to post your photos? When is it going to get you the most likes, the most views, things like that?
Just about everyone has their phones in hand.
You guys, feel free to get up whenever you're ready to start taking some pictures.
Then they're out of their seats taking pictures of the display of food laid out before them. Burricata with ricotta cheese, ribeye steak with roasted fingerling potatoes, flatbread pizza.
Using your flash sometimes can kind of bleach out your picture. I've had friends who I make hold up their phone flashlight behind me just so you can get the right light.
Schuster is a social media strategist for the public relations firm that's putting on this event, a recent graduate of journalism school, and a self-identified millennial. And she knows her job is exactly that.
Very millennial thing.
But she also knows social media savvy is now a commodity.
You're trying to drive people to your business.
Instagram, the smartphone app in which users post photos for their followers to see, like, and comment on, is just one social media tool that's becoming increasingly important for businesses, bloggers, photographers, authors, well, just about anyone in building their personal brand.
It's definitely how businesses are marketing now, and people, millennials, people in their 20s and 30s and things like that, that's how people are finding restaurants, that's how people are finding online clothing stores, things that you are out of town, out of state, that you would never hear about.
And it's true. Talking to this gathering of people, it's clear that personal branding and figuring out how to garner coveted Instagram likes, or what Schuster calls engagement, is key.
I am an intern at Arizona Foothills, which is a local luxury magazine. So I just came to try to get some experience and figure out what I can do better.
I actually have an Italian shoe store at Scottsdale Fashion Square. And I'm one of the owners, and we have our Instagram account for the business.
That was Maggie Lorenzen and Sherry Shahriari, who came to the class. Renee Fuentes came because she just started a food blog.
I'm a stay-at-home mom, so this is kind of my hobby that I'm doing right now.
But Ann Stussy doesn't even have an Instagram account, though her daughter tells her it's the thing these days.
Are you going to start an Instagram account?
That's kind of time-consuming, but, you know, we'll see.
And that's a sentiment Michael Press, the executive chef here at Tansy Restaurant, can relate to.
I think maybe that has held me back in the past. You're like, oh God, you know, I just want to get back behind the line. Or
Press swears he'll get better at posting on his Instagram account, but he says sometimes he just wants to butcher a side of tuna.
I don't want to take 10 minutes to take a picture of me butchering a side of tuna. I just want to get it done because I know I'm going to need it for tonight's service. But in this day and age, it's part of business. It's part of being a chef.
So, Lauren, if it's so time-consuming, why do so many of us spend so much time doing it?
Right. I actually wondered why I do it. So I brought in Alex Halavay. He's the director of the Masters in Social Technologies program at Arizona State University, which means he's a sociologist who studies social media and how people learn from it. And when I asked him about all of this, he said this isn't inherently bad or selfish or unhealthy. Sure, it can be, but he doesn't think it's actually even all that new.
Really, what we're seeing is not a trend, but a return to what we used to do, which is tell stories to each other. I think this is, we're in it for the long term. Of course, it'll change, the technologies will change, but this idea of mass interaction, that is not one person interacting with everyone, not broadcasting, but and not one-to-one, you phoning a friend, but this kind of large numbers of people being able to talk to large numbers of people is at once a return to the way we used to be, in the small town, and also kind of where we're going, this kind of move towards this mass interaction.
What strikes me about that is that it doesn't seem like you think we've changed as humans all that much. It just is a different medium.
Yeah, no, I think some part of me thinks that we're actually returning to something very basic, which is, I want to tell you a story. It's no longer, you know, this matter of, have you seen the same film I've seen, but have you seen the rainstorm that just hit Phoenix in the same way that I and my friends have seen it? So it seems to me to be very basic to who we are. And yes, it's mediated through these things that seem very foreign and unfamiliar, but the basic things we're doing are human.
So then I wonder, like, why do we make fun of them? And I think this is a real thing. Like, you see people taking selfies and you'll laugh at them. Or, like, you know, the guy who falls into a lake because he's trying to take a picture of himself and his dog. So what is that urge then, if this is nothing new and we've kind of always been willing to do this?
So, yeah, actually, I went out to Breadfruit and Rum Bar, which is downtown, and they served this amazing plate. It was just beautiful. And I literally felt my hand reaching for the phone and then thought, first of all, I'm going to ruin the moment I was there with my wife. And second of all, I'll look ridiculous, you know? And so I totally get that. And one of the things about presenting yourself is it's supposed to be effortless, right? None of this is supposed to be constructed. You're supposed to, you know, do not look behind the curtain. It's all supposed to just be natural. And that's part of the, you know, it's part of the conceit. You're supposed to do it so well that you're kind of, revealing the true self in taking this picture, right? Mm-hmm. But we do have to hide that. It's frustrating in some ways. And so, you know, I think part of it is just anything new you want to make fun of until it's normal. But part of it is it's supposed to be natural, and so you're supposed to hide the constructed nature of it.
Right, right. So I don't want to ask, as my final question, is this healthy? But I do want to ask, since you said that you look at how people learn from this, so how is that shaping the way in which maybe, you know, this millennial generation we talk about learns?
So there's two answers to that, right? One is that they're definitely modeling themselves after what they're seeing online, modeling themselves after those who are famous online for one reason or another. There are two ways they can follow that. And one is by comparing themselves to that person. And in many cases, that leads to some very unhealthy behaviors. But many people also just engage in it by producing their own goods and producing their own image. And in that case, I think it is, you know, without being too Pollyannish, kind of this dawn of a new age of being able to express yourself creatively without having to spend a lot of money or time. You know, you have this ability to be creative in a way that you haven't in the past. And I think overall, that's spectacular.
Fascinating stuff. KJZZ's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you, Mark.
How much can we talk politics at the office? The issue seems to come up every 2 years as elections loom. This year, the WNBA fined players, including some on the Phoenix Mercury, for wearing shirts in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. The league later rescinded those fines. So what legal protections do employees have on subjects like this one? To find out, we call on Paul Bender, a professor at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at ASU. And Paul, what are the legal rules of the road as far as workers expressing political views?
It all depends on who you're working for. If you work for a government, the government is constrained by the First Amendment to the Constitution and the equivalent provision of the Arizona Constitution, and you have free speech rights versus the government. If you're working for a private employer, you don't have any free speech rights vis-a-vis the private employer. The First Amendment only restrains government.
So in the private sector, then, is it just basically up to the employer to for how far they want to allow their employees to go, how much expression that they want to give them?
Unless there's a law that restricts them. There could be a law which says, just as there are laws that say you can't fire people because of their race, there could be laws or religion or gender. There could be laws which say you can't fire people because of their political speech. I don't know if anybody has those, but I'm pretty sure Arizona does not.
In the government sector, though, there are limits, aren't there, as to when and where workers are allowed to express political views?
Yeah, sure. My impression is that the courts have been pretty liberal toward government employers in letting them restrict the political speech of their employees when there's a reason to believe that that political speech may interfere with the employee doing the job properly. For example, just take a simple example. Suppose police officers started wearing election buttons on their uniforms. I think the police department could say, hey, we don't want you to do that because when you have interactions with people, we want them to think you're completely neutral about stuff like that. And if you seem to be a political partisan, that would not be a good thing for the community. People would not have the same respect for you. I think courts have been pretty loose with regard to letting employers set those kinds of rules, as long as they leave the opportunity for employees to engage in political speech by talking to each other at lunch breaks or something like that, or just when they're not doing anything else.
You referenced police officers in your hypothetical example of the agency maybe not wanting officers to be wearing campaign buttons.
Right.
In the case of an organization like the WNBA, they didn't fire players. They attempted to fine them and then later rescinded them. Maybe not so much from a legal perspective, but just from a perceptions perspective, how do employers go about trying to allow their workers to express themselves, but also maybe not turning off fans, clients, sponsors, other people that, you know, that they're trying to appeal to?
Well, it's a problem, and that's probably why the WNBA decided that they wanted to fine the players. I don't know how they make decisions like that, because it seems to me if you say to a player, where you can't wear a T-shirt like that, Some people will be offended by that you stopped the player. Other people will like it. So if you're the basketball team, I don't know how you make that decision.
Paul Bender is a professor in the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at ASU. Would we all be more productive if we worked shorter hours? Many countries that have long working hours have some of the worst productivity. A company in the Netherlands is pioneering a particularly radical way of making sure everyone stops work on time by removing their office furniture. The BBC's Paul Henley investigates.
These are the offices of Helder Groen, or Bright Green, a creative and advertising agency which ends its employees' working day by making their desks and computers vanish into the ceiling on the dot of six. It's got vast windows overlooking a broad canal in an industrial area with the church spires and windmills of the city centre in the distance. The staff, there are just over a dozen of them, look and act as if they've recently come off the beach in Ibiza.
After six, you want to clean your head. And sometimes I go to the massage, Thai massage, or jogging, or sport, or tennis.
The interior is oak, slate, and steel. There are black candles, bowls of avocados and lemons, and an expensive coffee machine. The big wooden-top tables in this office are all suspended on thin metal cords from white boxes in the high ceiling. The boxes are covered in a mixture of paper and fishbone, which helps the room's acoustics by absorbing echo. And the actual process of drawing the desks up into them, the reveal I'm waiting for, is one stolen from the theatre and scene-changing. Bart Kellerhaus is the designer.
Now it's on a working level, all the tables are down, but you can also raise them on DJ level. You have a party, you could raise one of them, and you could do everything with it. It's like a super organism, and it generates new ideas.
In the end, it's the reaction of the people who work here that matters.
I have a small baby. The fact that we have a 9-to-6 set hours does help a lot. The way the office is set up is quite unique, with the desks that go up and just the robust industrial look and feel.
Everyone here works in an industry well known for its late finishes, tight deadlines and stress. So their desks disappearing in front of their eyes at six is something to be savoured.
When you stop working, you lift the tables and then it's really, really done. So you leave an empty space behind and it feels like a closure. It's easy to think, oh no, just this and just that, just answer this email, and before you know it, it's 6:30.
And not like being back at school and having the school bell at the end of the day, at the end of the lesson?
Well, I don't know if you notice, but whenever the school bell goes, the children run outside cheering, so I think it's a good thing.
Sander Veenendaal's idea when he founded this company was to be different, more relaxed, but keeping a strict eye on productivity too.
So I want to design a process where people can feel really good and can challenge each other, and I want them to work hard as well. So the environment should be challenging for them to do so.
But what's all this got to do with retractable desks?
It's a ritual which says there's a time and a space to start working. So that's why the desks are coming up and going down.
It's a quasi-religious thing, it sounds like.
Corporate is religion, I think.
That report from the BBC's Paul Henley. By now you've probably heard of Odyssey Aquarium, the multi-million gallon aquarium slated to open this year near North Scottsdale. Well, they're adding another attraction to the same complex that will use water in a different form, frozen. The idea is to make an ice lounge with games, decor, and walls all made of ice. The show's Annika Klein visited a local ice sculptor who's chipping away at the project block by block.
Mark Armitage has been making ice sculptures in the valley for more than 10 years.
Using chainsaw, chisels, routers, a lot of specialty bits.
How cold is it in here?
23 degrees.
His indoor freezer is a small shelter from the heat outside. Here he mostly carves pieces for corporate events, sculptures used for one night only.
These will be liquor luges going to a bar in Scottsdale.
Imagine alcohol sliding down a tiny ski slope before landing in a martini glass. But now Armitage is working on something much bigger. A 3,500 square foot lounge and play area called Polar Play, where visitors can chill out in a space made almost completely out of ice.
You don't typically think of ice being used for games.
But Polar Play is essentially a giant freezer, which means the ice checkerboard or cornhole game won't melt. Neither will the life-size polar bear or penguin sculptures.
And then there'll be like a 12-foot bar that's 20 blocks of ice.
Giving a whole new meaning to ordering a cocktail on the rocks. But the woman behind the concept doesn't just want it to be seen as an ice bar. Judy Peterson Fleming hopes families can enjoy the space too, and even learn from it.
One thing that I've really wanted to do through my career is just educate people about polar environments, both the South and the North.
She comes from the aquarium industry, and she sees this as an extension of that. There won't be live animals living in polar play, but she's devised a scavenger hunt for people to find facts about the poles.
Penguins live in the South Pole, polar bears live in the North Pole. I mean, incredibly intelligent people are like, what? I thought they lived together.
There are still some unknowns with the project, though. Here's Armitage.
Ice is fragile. You know, it's easy to break and they're slippery, so I'm trying to figure out how that's going to work.
He doesn't want to slip up on safety, so the floors will be fall resistant. And they'll hand out winter clothing to visitors who might show up in shorts and flip-flops. The next consideration is this.
Ice is more or less a living thing that changes with time, so you have to always keep up with it. We will be in there every week, touching it up, making sure that everything stays the way it's supposed to be.
That is the challenge, to keep the ice fresh, but it's also the opportunity.
Peterson Fleming says the impermanence of ice means she gets to reimagine the space in the future.
Because it's not like fixed furniture, so we can switch it out on different occasions and holidays.
She says the ice itself is cheap. The air conditioning bill probably won't be. But Armitage has made a business out of ice in the desert for years and says the hot location makes it even cooler.
That in itself is part of the attraction. People want to see it. I'm hoping people still want to see it in January. But in the summertime, oh yeah, people will be very happy to be walking in there.
They plan to open the doors next month. And until then, Armitage and his sculptors have their work cut out for them. Or rather, they'll be cutting, chiseling, and sawing 500 blocks of ice into something rarely experienced in the valley. 23 degrees above zero. For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.